When was the last time I took a road trip? How many national parks could I hit in 2 weeks? What about hotels? Wait, hey, Erica, how much am I spending on travel?
When your questions about life turn into questions about money, there's Erica, the virtual financial assistant to help you spend, save, and plan smarter. Only from Bank of America. What would you like the power to do? Erica is only available in the English language. You must download the latest version of the mobile banking app, only available on select mobile devices. Your chat may be recorded and monitored for quality assurance. Message and data rates and additional terms may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. For over 30 years, Merrick has crafted high-quality dog food. Since our founding in Hereford, Texas, all of Merrick's recipes have prioritized whole nutrition with deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. That's why we say real is our recipe. Real ingredients and homestyle flavors your pet loves. Look for new Merrick packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. Find it online or in your local pet store.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Farah.
So when we agreed to do this podcast, I told you that as your producer, I'll be frank and direct with you. I need to know, how do you stop yourself reaching for the bullshit?
The problem with whether you're a bullshitter or not is to an extent, something that only other people can decide. So I hesitate to go on record and say I'm definitely not a bullshitter.
Well, one thing there's no room for bullshit on is our quick fire round. Today, we're looking at the world of sport. Alex Ferguson or Arsene Wenger?
I think Alex Ferguson. Sport's about winning and he was a winner.
Football or rugby?
Rugby. I used to love football, but I think it's lost its soul.
Ooh, controversial. Serena Williams or Billie Jean King?
That is a difficult one. I think Serena Williams. And I don't have any really good reasons other than I just love watching her play tennis.
In the stadium or on the sofa?
I mean, officially, because I'm like really cool and authentic and all those kind of things in the stadium. But in reality, secretly, I prefer the sofa.
On the pitch, referees or VAR?
On the pitch. Keep it real. Keep it authentic.
And finally, Bradley Wiggins or Chris Hoy?
Brad Wiggins. I know all the stuff has come out and I know he's, let's say politely put, polarizing, but that 2012 when he won the Tour de France and he won that Olympic gold, that was just an absolutely iconic moment in time. Hello and welcome to this special live recording of the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast, powered by Intelligence Squared. I'm Chris Hurst and my guest today is none other than the sporting legend Sir Clive Woodward. Clive, when I went onto your website, the homepage says, how do you want to be remembered? And I suspect you'll be remembered as the World Cup winning head coach who led England's rugby team to World Cup glory in Australia in 2003, who, amongst us, can never forget. Not only was it the first time England won, but the first time any nation in the Northern Hemisphere won the Rugby World Cup, and still the only Northern Hemisphere nation. You then became Team GB's Director of Sport in the London Olympics in 2012, delivering Team GB's most successful Olympic Games in modern times, and you're now a sports and business consultant and founder of Hive Learning, an app which digitises your coaching methods. Thank you for joining us this evening, Clive.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks for that introduction. I've forgotten most of those things.
None of the rest of us have, Clive. None of the rest of us have. In three words, describe your leadership style.
Leadership, teamship, and partnership.
If you could delete any word from the leadership jargon dictionary, what word would that be?
Oh, that's easy. I hate the word. I'm going to reach out to you.
Yeah. Which leader do you most admire, either present, past?
Yeah, Alex Ferguson. Although I'm a big Chelsea fan, I hate Man United, but Ferguson was the best leader I've come across in sport by a long way.
And what's the best advice you've ever been given?
Be curious, but I think write things down because you think you may remember them, but you can't. So I've even now got a pen, just in case I learn something from you, Chris.
I think that's unlikely, but let's see. It's flattering nevertheless. What's the best decision you've ever made?
We went to live in Australia, I think, to go and work abroad. I went there when I was 29. So I think I stayed there for 5 years. I had a two-year contract with Xerox, stayed there 5 years. So just to work abroad was really excellent time of our life. And I think it just makes you independent, and I advise that to anybody. If there's a chance of working abroad, just do it.
And the worst decision you've ever made?
Probably not to go to Australia about 5 years earlier.
I had a look at your website before tonight's recording, and it asks, and I mentioned this in the introduction, how do you want to be remembered? I was presumptuous enough to answer that question for you, but how do you want to be remembered as a leader and a coach?
When you're in leadership positions, you know, I love the word trust and respect. I've always, you know, when people ask me about other leaders, you know, Alex Ferguson, you kind of trust and respect. And I think the key thing to stress, well, I'm absolutely clear, but you don't get those names associated with you just because you happen to be the leader or the head coach or the chief executive. You get them just by the quality of your actions. And, you know, I always say that to leaders, you are there to set the example, and it's not rocket science. It's you've got to throw the kitchen sink at it. And certainly from a sporting point of view, I kind of still think as a player, you know the coaches who are re-delivering by what they're doing. You know the coaches who are maybe taking a few shortcuts.
And you've had some incredible highlights so far. What is the highlight for you, whether it be a kind of a real sort of headline achievement or maybe some specific moment within that? What's been the highlight?
Well, I've been very lucky about it because the Rugby World Cup win was huge, because, you know, I didn't take the England job on to actually win the Rugby World Cup. I took that job on to try and make England the best team in the world, I mean, the number one ranked team in the world. But that one night in Sydney was just the kind of the absolutely icing on the cake. Everybody could see this was a very special team. As you said, no one's ever done that before from our part of the world. So that would be the highlight. But I've always been pleased. I moved on from rugby pretty quick. I kind of had a bit of fallout with one or two people at Twickenham after the World Cup and left. And in a year of professional football, I love football. I had a year of professional football, which I love. I'm a fully qualified football coach. So even getting that qualification, I'm hugely proud of. Then the Olympic Games, wasn't just London. I was in charge of the sporting side of the team in Beijing in 2008, Vancouver, the Winter Olympics, obviously London 2012. So huge highlights all through that. But what I've been kind of most proud of, been looking, and I'm not finished yet by a long way, is actually just, you know, moving on and not sort of, you know, it's great talking about World Cups and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I moved on pretty quickly to find new challenges, new things to do. And yeah, I still love rugby. I enjoy watching the game, but I've never kind of regretted moving on from the game of rugby.
The World Cup in particular, obviously such an iconic final, not just the winning, but the way it was won. Are you the sort of person that manages to find time to enjoy the moment? I think Johnny Wilkinson sort of famously said, didn't he, that he sort of enjoyed it for about 2 seconds and then just felt a sense of relief. Well, were you able to just really, at the time, reflect on what you'd achieved and sit back and enjoy it?
You probably reflect on it more sort of now, really, just talking to you. You look back at a lot of warm feelings. At the time, when the word used there was relief, to me, it was just a massive relief when that final whistle went. You know, it was just, thank goodness for that. And also, you know, there's no second chance. That was never going to happen again. There's no next week or try again. That was it. And if we'd not won that game, I haven't a clue how I would have turned out. I don't think probably very well. And I don't think any of us would have, because we knew it was a chance of a lifetime. And that was pressure. But the pressure was great. You wouldn't swap it for anything. I loved the pressure of it.
I remember, and I'm not trying to compare the two, but I remember when I first found myself in a leadership position, as in right at the top of a business, and I knew what I wanted to achieve, but I don't think I had a very clear leadership philosophy of my own. I mean, when you first became the head coach, did you have a clear plan for how you were going to go about it, or did your thinking evolve as you went through?
Do you want the truth, or do you want...
Yeah, we definitely want the truth.
I didn't have a clue what I was doing. You know, I can look back now. I can say all these wonderful things, but when I say I didn't have a clue, of course I did. But when I got the England rugby job, I think the key thing everyone should understand, I had kind of two careers in business before that. I worked for Xerox, ran Xerox for 8 years, including 5 in Australia. So, you know, and I was a graduate trainee, and I was a sales director in Sydney. So I had a a big corporate background. But probably most importantly, when we came back from Australia, I set up my own small leasing and finance company based on the skills I learned with Xerox Finance. We're a small brokerage. So when I say small, it's about 10 people. They also ran for eight years. So I had a big corporate background in terms of Xerox, graduate training, all that sort of stuff. But probably the most important thing was running your own company where you've got 10 people in the room. You know, and I really look back at that time running my own small finance company. That was the key skills I learned in terms of taking over the rugby team. I couldn't write it down or anything, but you just throw in the kitchen sink at it. You realize you've got to really listen to your people. You've got to make them engage with it. But, you know, we had no HR. We had 10 people sat in a room, and we took on some big guys and some of these big deals. I had a lot of fun. I learned so much in that 8 years, learned more in that 8 years than anything else. And so when you talk about the rugby team, there's no difference. You know, I think when I think about, you know, rugby and sport, rugby and business, you know, you're delivering results through people. That's what leadership's about. You're not delivering it through yourself. You're delivering results through people. But when you think of it, that's the definition of a rugby team, a football team, any business team. You're just finding ways to really, you know, engage and empower your team and away you go. And I kind of loved it. This is interesting. You know, whilst I love coaching England, I love running my own business. There's no greater buzz than being absolutely the guy in charge. Everything's on the line. You know, school fees, the house. There's no one looking after you. But I learned from both. I learned from a big corporate background, and I learned especially from running my own small company. And when I took over the rugby team, often the players would probably used to drive them nuts. They used to refer to business all the time with them about what we did and how we did things. You know, I like to think they learned quite a bit. You know, I made no difference. This is a business. You know, and we're here to win, and that's the game.
What do you think are the big similarities and potentially differences between leadership in a sports context and leadership in a business context?
I honestly don't think there is, Chris. I really don't. The two key skills gets is just what I call relentless learning. You're always learning. There's no doubt you look at these great football managers, they're always learning, always trying to find new things, new edges. They're not sitting there thinking, oh, great, we've cracked it. Learning is everything. And the key thing is if you get the learning done through your people, so it's not just yourself who is a relentless learner. You're encouraging every single person in the team. One of my favourite sayings in the rugby team, there's no such thing as a dumb idea. You know, because sometimes a new player would come into the team, you know, even a young Johnny Wilkinson. When Johnny came into the England rugby team, he was 18, amazing young man, superstar player. But he was so shy. He was so quiet. He was almost intimidated by the more senior players. And then you got me asking him to stand up and speak in front of these players, and he just couldn't. But I, you know, I made it clear, you've got to get everybody involved. If you've got an idea, you say it, you stand up. Doesn't matter if you leave yourself open for some banter or ridicule. Let me decide whether it's a good or bad idea. What I pride myself on is listening and making sure all these players are really empowered to think about things. And then what I am thinking I'm quite good at, if I think that's a good idea that you've thought about, if that's going to, you know, in sporting terms, make the boat go faster, I'll move heaven and earth to get it done. You have to do it. That's your job. So if this is going to make you a better team, win more gold medals, make the boat go faster, we will do it. We'll get it done. Doesn't matter what it costs. It has to happen.
I love listening to you talk about that, because I know you and I have a shared sort of passion, if that's the right word, for the power of culture within an organisation to drive that organisation's success or, if you get it wrong, failure. Johnny Wilkins or whoever it is, you know, without you, he doesn't stand up and speak, does he? I mean, your role there is to create the culture and the environment to make that happen. And I think that's a critical role for leaders.
When I'm thinking about this, you know, one of my favourite sayings, and I said this to players, great teams made a great individuals, and I repeat it, great teams made a great individuals. My job with the rugby team is to make every individual player better. So I'm going to make Martin Johnson, Johnny Wilkinson, Lawrence Delalio, my job is to make them better at what they do. And if you get every individual, think of your business people, your salespeople, your marketing people, your forklift truck driver, if you invest in them and you're going to try and make that individual better, you know, they will give it back to you in bucket loads. And I really do mean it. And they'll know whether you're bullshitting or not. So is this guy delivering? Is he making me a better player? You know, a sports team or a business team, you look around the room and suddenly you see all these amazing individuals who are superstar players. The team stuff, Chris, becomes quite easy to do. And that's how I've always worked, you know. And hence, a rugby team is quite interesting because it's so different than even a football team, because there's so many different positions and different sizes. So I want to make every single player as best they possibly can. And that's a huge challenge because that keeps you awake at night. But when I'm running my business from, you know, the secretary to the market, I'm trying to, you know, what have I got to do to make you better at your job? And if you do that, they won't forget that. And that's why I spoke before about trust and respect. I think you get that. If you do it, if you just talk about it and you talk a good game, you know, you can't hide from these people. They know whether you're delivering or not.
I could talk to you about the rugby team all night, but I also want to talk about the Olympics. You just compared to the rugby team to, let's say, a kind of a sort of a startup business almost. To extend that analogy, the Olympic team was like running a kind of huge corporation, I suppose, in terms of scale. What were the differences in terms of the leadership style you had to pursue, I suppose, as director of sport at the Olympics?
Yeah, it was a very different job, Chris. I mean, in the rugby team, I'm the head coach. The Olympic team, I was kind of overseeing the 26 sports, you know, so my job is to make sure these 26 sports really operated together. And there were 26 totally different businesses, you know, from British Cycling to Dave Brailsford, some amazing teams. And then, but the whole range of sports in terms of different cultures, different personality, different fundings, you know, British boxing, taekwondo, hockey. So you've got 26 totally different businesses. And all the silos, that's the best way to look at it. Very different. Some of these sports didn't even get on with each other, you know, because they were competing for funds from UK sport. Mm. So there wasn't a lot of love lost between some of these sports and people, which totally surprised me, because I got the offer of this job. I came out of the blue. I was about to become a football manager. And a guy called Colin Moynihan, used to be the Minister of Sport, Lloyd Moynihan, who I'd met a couple of times and really liked. He was got hold of me and he said, look, we've won the bid. We know you're in football, but we're going to create this new job. And it's not quite what you normally do, because it's more of a, it's not an admin role, because I'm overseeing these coaches. I had to go head to head with all these pretty aggressive, you know, winners like Brailsford and try and sort of create this team. Looking back, I'm really glad I did it. It was an amazing job to actually see firsthand, because it allowed me to go behind the scenes. You know, I could go behind the scenes of all these sports. You know, I have the saying about being a sponge or a rock, and I'm a total sponge. I'll go anywhere if it means I can learn something. And just to sit in the back of team rooms and cycling athletics and just see the way different things are run. But also, you can see there was, you know, when you look at these superstar athletes, you know, from Bradley Wiggins to Victoria Pendleton to Johnny Wilkins to Mark Johnson, they're actually the same. They're just doing different sports. They're incredibly driven and they want to win. But also, what Kim got really clear was, you know, it's not just one way. They don't just sit there and listen to the coaches. They work with the coach. They question the coach, and their knowledge of their sports. Like, you know, I talked about relentless learning before. It was only then I started to write things down and try and work out what on earth I had done with the rugby team. Because until then, as you say, I was just throwing everything at it. But then I was able to actually see why we were successful and what the comparisons were with some Olympic sports that were successful and some of the sports that weren't so successful. But it's a business. It was back to delivering results through people. But it was a great job, but I was more in an administration role. But, you know, it wasn't plain sailing. I was really surprised at the animosity between some of these sports, because you kind of watch on TV, like we've all done, the Olympic Games, amazing TV. You see Team GB, they're all in the nice track suits and walking around. Behind the scenes, it's not quite like that. There's a lot of angst, a lot of tensions, a lot of personalities, a lot of blow-ups. And my job was to make sure that didn't happen, basically.
And, I mean, is that where you develop your concept of teamship? I mean, do you want us to talk a bit about that?
No, the teamship came from a small business. You know, I kind of read a lot of, for every one sports book I read 10 business books, but I've never read about teamship. And all teamship is, it's very, very simple, but is if I try and make it as simple as possible. If I'm use my own small company, I'm the leader of the team. I've got 10 people in my team. Without being too dramatic, I wanted the team to discuss, you know, what we're going to do about certain things, what our standards were going to be, our behaviours and all this sort of stuff. And literally, I wouldn't be in the room. And I'd ask one of the team to, you know, have a chat about it, the whole thing, and kind of report back to me and say, what do you think? And then it can become what I call a teamship rule if you get 100% agreement from the team, but most important, the leader also agrees. So if the team comes back with an idea, this is what we want to do, we all agree this is the way to do this. If you don't like it, you still back it back. So it's not democracy, you're not giving any power away. But it's what I said before, you actually would be, you're showing your team that I am listening to you, I do respect and understand you. You know, fundamentally, I still think as a player, I could still remember sitting there as a rugby player thinking, God, if I was doing this job, I'd be doing it differently than this. So it's just empowering your team. I call it teamship. And in the England rugby team, we literally had hundreds of teamship rules, hundreds. Obviously, some to do with playing the game, but most is about our behaviours. My favourite one was time. I think time says more about an individual or team of people than anything I think of. Punctuality. You know, I'm never late, ever. There'd have to be a serious incident for me not to be on time for somebody. But, you know, so I sat down with the team one day. I went through all my definition of punctuality, starting on time, finishing, all this sort of stuff. So I want to know your definition. So I literally left the room. And this is what this is why they were so good. You know, Martin Johnson especially, he got this. So I came back in and John gave me a bit of paper and he said, you know, we get this. Our definition of time will be 10 minutes early. So if you call a meeting tonight to start at 7 o'clock, we'll be in all the room by 6:50. So you, the leader, read this. You're going to accept this. And 10 minutes early is totally possible in a sporting team. So it's not in a business in that sense. So you sign off on it. And then you kind of name it. We named it Lombardi time, after an American football coach called Vince Lombardi. And I promise you, anybody listening to this call, if you ever meet any rugby player who played under me, just go Lombardi time and they'll go 10 minutes early. And even now I meet players, everyone's 10 minutes early and they laugh. So your teamship will create your culture. But the most important thing, if I'd gone to the team and go, right, here's the rules, 10 minutes early, they'd all just fold their arms and go, this is all bullshit. Because you get them to discuss it, them to decide it, and also most importantly, them to agree it. They take ownership of it and they get hugely proud of it. And if anybody was late, it doesn't need me to tell them, that the team would call it out. If you want to win, you can have these amazing teamship rules. And what it allows you to, you know, if you think what's happening today in today's world with, you know, all that's going on in Black Lives Matter, what teamship allows you to get those things out on the table, get them discussed. Don't hide behind anything. And I think if people did that a lot more often and encourage your team, if there's anything you think we should be doing better or you're not happy with, get it out on the table, get it on the table, create a teamship rule around it. And I've never read about it in any book, but it's got to be driven by the leader of the actual team.
The leader, it almost instigates that culture, I suppose. But as I understand it, the team almost, I'm trying to avoid using the word police because that's too hard, but the team self-enforces those rules, right? I mean, it's not for you to sort of say, hang on, I'm going to tell you off. It's that they hold themselves to those rules that they themselves have set.
What happens is we're trying to be the best team in the world, and literally no one's ever late. No one's ever late. It didn't need policing. And this isn't a contract. This is a firm shake of hands between this is how we're going to operate. I've agreed to do this. That's how we're going to work. You know, obviously somebody can arrive late. Things can happen. But if somebody then knowingly arrives late, you've got a major problem. When you know you've really cracked it, when your team comes to you, so let's discuss this. Can we discuss this? Can we discuss this? And then you go on from, and it never stops. You're always adding to them. You're always tweaking them. You're always building on them. But that England rugby team that won, the way they operated off the field of play was just the best I've ever seen in any business or in any sport. And then you can move it onto the field of play where you start to discuss, you know, what are we going to do from here, here, and here? Because all these brains, and I'm just saying we need to use these brains. These just because they play doesn't mean they're not clever. They're incredibly bright and they understand the game they want to win. So it's just called teamship, and you know, I wouldn't know any other way of working with any team of people. I couldn't. I just know how to do it. If I'm running, you know, a golf club amateur committee, that's how I do it. Same thing. We need to have a clear ways of working that we're all happy with. But if it's 9 out of 10 people say yes, we'll do it this way, and one says no, it cannot become a teamship rule because that person might be right. That could be the killer idea. It's not just a majority rules. You've got to have every single person. That's what we're going to do. And there'll come a stage where you, as the leader, go, okay, we're just going to get on with this now. Even if I'm not quite there, we'll try it for a couple of months and see how we get on with this, because you can change it. So teamship is a style of leadership. It's not a one-off sort of project. So it's a style of leadership where you really are engaging with your team and listening.
I love, in a way, fitting these two big concepts we've talked about together, this idea of creating an environment where everybody gets to speak. You talked about the Johnny Wilkinson example. You know, you're creating the environment where he or she, whoever, whatever the context is able to say whatever's on their mind, a worry, a concern, an idea, and at the same time then having a framework for a discussion and a decision with the group as to whether that is something they're going to embrace and work with. It's kind of two sides of the same coin in some ways.
Be very clear, in the team room we had some humdingers. Just because you kind of win a World Cup, everyone seems to think it's something that's wonderful. It wasn't. Sometimes it got really quite tasty in there, if you know what I mean, because we wanted to win.
And some big guys.
Yeah, some big guys. But it all kicked off at times. But the teamship rule was, there's nothing wrong with disagreeing in the team room. But but quite simply, the teamship rule, when we walk out that door, we all walk out the door holding hands. There's nothing comes out of that team room. But we want disagreement. We want questions. We want arguments. We want people calling people out. That's what high-performing teams do. But no one ever fell out. There's never not quite any blood on the carpet. But we had a few moments where you've got to go, guys, calm down. You know, and especially with some of the games we lost, you know, we did some of the analysis on the TV. You know, someone said, what were you doing? You shouldn't have said that to him. So we, even that was team shit rules. And the team room was a magic place. We had this, you know, I put a lot of stall on the team room, which is, it's kind of more than the boardroom. And we made it a place when that door was shut, right, it wasn't there for a chat. But what it has, it was quite noisy because I wanted them coming in with thoughts and ideas. And I would, you know, it wasn't me delegating. I would just say, what do you think? What do you think? So you get opinions through then. You know, then you've got the coaches who are no angels either, you know, Andy Robertson and Phil Lard and these guys, they're all winding up as well. So it became quite a hostile place at times, but it was, you wouldn't swap it for the world, you know. But also my little leasing company, every now and then it all kicked off in that because we didn't do it right or whatever. And, you know, we had to, that's where I learned it from. I relearned teamship from that small company. And, you know, we may kick off and say things in that room, but we'd just walk outside the door, high five each other. And get on with it, you know. We set our piece now, and Leave It on the Way Behind was another one of my favourite. You know, it's done now, it's going to move on, it's out the door, let's get on with it.
I definitely think that with effective teams, you have to be able to disagree, and disagree is a polite way of putting it, but without falling out. You know, you need to be able to have a real old proper row, and then at the end of it, say, let's go for, you know, we're both arguing about this because we deeply care. Let's get it out. Let's get it said, and let's go for a pint or whatever it is you want to do afterwards. Because I think if you don't, that's when you get to politics, schisms. People don't say their things that they feel. They tend build up.
I've spoken to Alex Ferguson about this, spoke to Toto Wolff about this, and they say the same thing. We almost laugh. Everyone thinks because you win, there's this beautiful thing, and actually, it isn't that beautiful, you know. And but that's why they all laugh, but they love it. I love it. I loved it. I loved the kind of confrontation within the team room because we wanted to win. We did want to win, and we're trying to create these amazing standards. And I think the players loved it. They absolutely loved it. And the kind of the humour also was all part of it. But, you know, that's what high-performing teams do. Sometimes it's not this wonderful, wonderful place. That's not the real world. You know, things do go wrong. You have big losses, you know, and all this sort of stuff. So it can happen, and you find out a lot about yourself in those situations as well.
You talked earlier about the best, you know, the great teams are made up of great individuals, and you I've heard you talk before about the DNA of a champion, that just talent alone isn't enough. What makes a champion, if not just talent?
Clearly, a champion, you've got to have talent. You can't take someone off the street and put him into a racing car or an England scrum or wherever. But once you've got talent, if you really want to try and leverage your talent, the biggest thing I come back to is this. Your ability to learn and really take ownership of your own program. Yes, you want to work with your coach and do things like that. You should listen to your coaches. But, you know, I love this term, relentless learning, where you're actually, and this is what I encourage the players to do. I'm encouraging them to go out and study, find out, come back to me. What do you think? How can we do this? How can we do that? And that's what champions do. I mean, Steve Redgrave, when he was 16, was nowhere. He's now the most successful Olympic athlete, and he was 16 years old. You know, he hardly could get in a boat. But he went on to be convinced by his sheer knowledge of what to do, how to do it, both physically, mentally, and he took really ownership of his own program. And that's why I see in a lot of these champion athletes, you know, their knowledge of what they do is amazing. You know, and then on top of that, you know, I use the word attitude. I like the word attitude, Chris. I think attitude's a great word. But I don't think people are born with attitude. I think you can coach attitude. So I break attitude down into 10 areas. And each of these 10 areas, there's a whole presentation on each one of them, but it allows me to measure attitude. And it is things like punctuality. It's been like obsession and these sort of words. But it adds up to has he or she got the right attitude. So if you get somebody who's relentless learning, got the right attitude, and they've got talent, you can take them anywhere.
I'd love to talk to you briefly about innovation as well. We're hopefully coming to the end of a very, very strange time in all of our lives, and certainly in business, that's going to mean a huge amount of change, and I think some creative destruction probably as well. And I think we're going to see as a consequence that a huge amount of innovation in all sorts of parts of our business lives, all aspects of our lives. What role has innovation, conscious innovation, played in your sort of leadership journey? And do you see yourself as an innovator, as a leader?
No, that's bad. I've never even thought about it, to be fair. What I've always believed in, and this probably came from my Xerox background, whoever wins in IT tends to win. certainly in the sporting world, when I became the rugby coach, that was the first time I was a full-time professional coach. I was, you know, we had no excuses. And I went massive on the IT side, massive. But what we did was, and at the time, probably, you know, when I first took over the rugby team, less than 5% of the team had a clue how to use a laptop computer. I mean, the players from Leicester, my club, couldn't spell laptop computer. So this was going to be quite challenging. But I wasn't doing it to be a geek or, you know, because, you know, some of the players go, what are you doing? You know, and the press, you know, had a field day, you know, because all these tough nut players walking into the hotel with laptop computers. I mean, I can see some headlines now. There's one guy, what on earth is he doing? What has a laptop computer got to do with playing rugby? Why is he not giving them all raw meat, was his headline. And I can remember at the time some of the players, because they couldn't use this stuff, but quite simply, when we explained to them why we're doing this, and also, you know, they were quite interested in the technology side of things, and we brought the very best trainers in. But when we showed them some of the software programs available, the key was getting them to use the software to analyse their own performance, whether it's on the field of play or off the field of play. And that at the time was just completely groundbreaking. People thought I was starting bonkers. But there, you know, and there were one or two casualties. This wasn't a kind of a nice to do thing. This was, you know, this was a line in the sand, unless you're going to take technology seriously. And I just think today, you know, so many people, so also, you know, when I work with some senior executives, it's amazing, you know, that they kind of usually want to show me some sort of software or data to start with. I'm always going to ask the first question, who uses this? Who uses this? And almost 9 times out of 10, it becomes a badge of honour. That's not my job anymore. I'm too senior to do all this. You know, we've got these bright young things from Oxford and Cambridge, these analysts down here. Massive mistake. You've already gone away from the technology world. The whole thing of technology is using your experience to make sure you make the right decisions based on what you're actually seeing. So, you know, if that's what you call innovation, it wasn't, to me, it was just common sense. You know, I wasn't kind of thinking I was going to be an innovator, but we weren't scared of trying new things. But technology's absolutely key. It's key today. Everything we're doing, even around the coronavirus, it all comes back to technology and who can move quickest and who can actually adapt quickly to what's going on. But I guess my Xerox background, my business background, I had no fear of technology because that was my job. I was there to sell technology from a very young age.
But one of your businesses now is a technology business, isn't it? With Hive as your kind of coaching tool. Would you talk a little bit about that and tell us what the ambition of that is?
Basically, what we did was it just digitized what I did longhand as a rugby coach. Because when we first started, I used this process when I kind of break down the game and we capture knowledge and information. But when we first started, I was capturing all this information just longhand. We had boxes and boxes of stuff. So it became really clear to me that there was the opportunity. So you just start to capture information. And this is how I coach people. If I'm going to work with you, Chris, I want you to almost imagine that we're going to write a book about what you do. So the first thing, what are your chapters? How do you break down what you actually do? Then once you've got your chapters, we're going to start to capture knowledge and information. I mean, really capture it. So this is where this thing comes in hand. So you're capturing all this stuff. You start to really study it. And this is what I call discover. And then you start to capture this information about the, you know, stuff in one of the chapters. And then I use the word, so it's actually called 3D learning. So the first is discover. So you're getting all the information about this. And you never stop learning. You're always discovering. The second D in 3D learning is what I call distill. So I have all this knowledge. You can try and distill it down to just a few key points. So I have all this amazing stuff. If we do these 6 things really well, the boat will go faster, whatever you want to say it. Then the third D in 3D learning is what I call do. So once you know your key points, you've distilled them down to key points, how do we practice this? How do we do this? And everything else. So your coaching will be creating your chapters, capturing knowledge and information, and then discover, distill, do. And it can all be done on this thing now, so it's with you all the time. And show other people. And we're just trying to find out. It's all about knowledge. And so this is what the whole Hive Learning is about.
How important has failure been in your journey, Clive? I mean, it's an occupational hazard, I guess, as a sports coach.
Well, I don't know anybody who's been successful who hasn't failed. I mean, it's failing just part of life. I mean, I think I'm probably the few coaches ever talked about failure before we failed. We used to have meetings in the team room about, okay, if we lose this game, what are we going to do? There's no point losing a game of rugby and then Saturday afternoon, 5 o'clock in the change room, how are we going to handle this? What are we going to do? So we used to talk about failure. And the key thing is planning for it. So when you do fail, you know how to handle it and handle it quickly. So it's not this massive big fallout. So and I think I learned this very much from my business. Like put in the business thing. What happens in business, and I was totally guilty of this to start with my own small leasing company, is that, you know, what happens when you, without being too glib, what happens when you win the big deal? you know, everyone down the pub, Friday night, big success, wow, we've won the big deal, massive overreaction. Then what happens when you lose the big deal? Everyone in Monday morning, 8 o'clock, massive, what happened? Big overreaction. What I learned to do was flip that. So in other words, when you lose the big deal, go down the pub, don't overreact. When you win the big deal, everyone in, 8 o'clock Monday morning, why do we win? What are the key points? How can we do it even better? You know, and you hear these terms, you know, like marginal gains and 100 things 1% better. That's all that is. So yes, you can learn from failure, but I don't think people learn, Chris, from success anywhere near as enough as they should do. So yes, focus on both, but I would weigh far more heavily really studying why you won. I mean, really studying and not just taking it for granted that you may have won for these, but really studying and trying to find out, and how can we do it better next time? If we're going to do it again, can we do it even better? You think of a game of rugby, you could win a game of rugby by playing awful. I call it success from setbacks. And I've spoken to sports coaches and they go, you can possibly speak to your team about failing. Well, you can. Because if you think, you start thinking the ramifications of failure, you don't want to fail. And it can become quite motivating, crikey, if we fail, this is what we're going to have to go through. So let's just part that now. We know what's going to happen if we do lose, but let's now focus on trying to win this thing. But no one knows, I've never known any sports coach talk about failure.
Fascinating. So we've got lots of questions. A question about the person you cited right at the start, Alex Ferguson. How much should leaders use anger? Alex Ferguson could famously be furious. Jose Mourinho seems frequently unhappy. Shouldn't leaders be optimistic and caring?
Alex Ferguson, for 95% of his time, I think, would be caring and all that sort of stuff. But every now and then, you have to. I did it once with the inner rugby team where I absolutely lost it in the changing room, lost it completely. You know, it kind of worked because they'd never seen me like that before. Because I needed to shock them, massively shock them, and not go through what we normally would do, which was kind of this very professional half-time routine and do all this sort of stuff. It was the classic teacup hair dry moment. And you can't do it all the time. They get fed up with it, just laugh at you. But if when it's needed, you have to be emotional every now and then. But it's just get the balance right. And I didn't ever plan to do it. Just every now and then, you've got to do it as a coach. And there's been some famous moments with Ferguson where I think he cut Beckham's lip once and chucked a boot at him or something, which when you're in our position, you just sort of smile and says, yeah, I can relate to that. He was just so mad at him. And he didn't mean to throw it at him, but he just threw it at him and hit him, I think. But he told me about that. And he obviously didn't aim at him. It was just an accident, but he did chuck something. But yeah, I think that's good. Same in business. Every now and then, you've got to become across that this is, you're not happy with things. But you've just got to, in business, be a little bit more clear in your thinking so you don't actually say something that you may really, really regret in terms of upsetting somebody.
Question from Andrew Wilson. What are your favourite questions to ask of those who you lead?
Yeah, I just ask them in terms of their learning. Show me what you learned today. Show me what you're doing. Can they show me anything? Show me their history. And if they can't, we've got to start quickly, because if it's all just stuck in your head, the chance that I'll be stuck in your head and you'll keep forgetting it. So I just want to know, you know, what they do on a regular basis to capture their own learnings, capture their expertise, and how can I help improve that? Because I think we can do it better if we work through that 3D learning process and get it and the people understanding that. And it's almost like I want to capture your IP. I want to make it better. I want to capture it, study it. How could we make you better at what you actually do? So that's my favorite question in a roundabout way.
And the final question from Francis Cody. You've talked a lot about this during the past hour, so I think I can guess the answer. But do we need to employ more people in corporations who've run their own small businesses?
Absolutely. I wouldn't say corporations. I would say governments. I would say people who are used to making decisions haven't had a big corporation behind them, you know, they're really putting it on the line, because they're the people I really admire, the small business mindset. You know, the best business leaders I know have all started off running their own companies. They've learnt, and you know, they've learnt the good lessons, bad lessons. They've learned how to win, they learn how to fail, which is really important. But they're there to make decisions. And I think sometimes top people in companies, they've got there without ever having to really make a decision, because they've always had the backing of a big corporation behind them. Same in government. What have they really done when you really get against the wall like we are at the moment? What have they really done to prove they've got the kind of the mindset, the bottle, the spine to kind of get through this? Because it's a business. That's what it is.
Thank you very much, Clive, for your time, for being with us, and for the absolutely fascinating chat. I've learned loads. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope you have too. And for those of you who are inspired by Clive's leadership style and would like to know more, he's doing a masterclass with Intelligence Squared on how to lead in a time of crisis. You can find out more details and book onto his masterclass by clicking the link in the podcast description. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.